Hi, everybody. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm working on a new daily interview and talk show for NPR called Tell Me More. We want to make it a show you really want to, well, tell people more about. So we're asking for your feedback before we actually go on the air. If you log on to npr.org/tellmemore, you can read my blog, listen to the segments, and let us know what you think. We like to think of our show as a safe place to have tough conversations. In that spirit, we bring you our regular segment called Behind Closed Doors, where we take on issues many people find hard to discuss. Today, we talk to a man who literally goes behind closed doors every day as part of his quest to help American families. He is Rabbi Shmuley Boteya. He is the host of the learning channels Shalom in the Home, where he helps families through some of their most difficult issues. Rabbi Shmuley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Michelle.
Rabbi, how did you get involved in counseling families? Did this grow out of your work as a rabbi?
Well, certainly, rabbis are counselors, and religion is supposed to address all of life's issues. It's actually quite a shame that religion today seems to focus more on heavenly, celestial matters, faith, prayer, charity, but doesn't focus on more terrestrial matters. You know, how do you keep marriages passionate and intimate? How do you raise inspired children? But for me, it's also more personal than that. My own parents divorced when I was a boy, and I've always pondered the question of how to keep marriages and families intact, how you create marital cohesion, how you really strengthen the parent-child bond, because the disintegration of the American family, I think, is our foremost national emergency, and we can't continue to ignore it.
One of the things I've noticed about the families that you work with on the program is their diversity. They're not people who all come from your religious background, racial background, cultural background. How do you find common ground with these families? It's like you get right into the heart of the thing.
Well, there's only one human family, and we're all equally God's children, and we all share a basic human nature. We all want to love and be loved. We all want to have a family where we find tranquility and peace. We all want to see our children flourish and prosper and become good people. I mean, these are things that transcend ethnicity, that transcends faith. In fact, I would say that when it comes to family, it is the area where we're all most united, where we have the most in common. I don't even see people's ethnicity, to be honest. I don't see their faith. I'm Jewish. I'm very proud of my Judaism. I use Jewish wisdom to counsel families. And when I go to counsel families, I think that they feel that I'm just a father and a husband who's trying to learn from his own experiences, but I'm using the benefit of my experiences to benefit them and their own families.
I wondered, is there ever a conflict between your own faith tradition and the circumstances you encounter in these families? I'm just wondering, do you ever have to struggle because their values and worldview are so different from yours?
No, religion and faith are never a stumbling block. They're never an obstacle in my relationship to families, ever. On the contrary, if anything, it's a unifying force. It draws me closer to the families. I'll give you an example. We even had a Muslim family, and the fact that they were people of faith made me feel immensely close to them. And it made me have a language with them that I couldn't always share with families who were completely secular.
What about if it's the other way, as you described, someone who's thoroughly secular, who perhaps has no frame of reference for a transcendent purpose?
Then it's one area where I may not have a lot in common with them, but there's 10 trillion other areas where I do. If it's a religious family, I can say to them that one of the shared family experiences that I would advocate is to go to synagogue, to church, to a mosque on a regular basis where kids, parents, and children can really unite on hallowed ground and for a special purpose. If it's a secular family, I'm not going to recommend that, obviously, but there's 10,000 other things they can do. They can go to the Cathedral of Nature, for example, hike in beautiful places and appreciate the wonder, awe, and mystery of nature.
Anna Karenina, the Tolstoy novel, famously begins that all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I wonder if that's really true. I'm wondering if it's the other way. Have you noticed similarities in why many of the families you work with are in trouble, despite their very different circumstances?
Anna Karenina is one of my favorite novels of all time, but I've always disagreed with Tolstoy's opening lines. I think families that are happy are also happy in their own way, because some of them excel in some are more passionate, some are more intimate, some are better at holidays and special celebrations, some are better at celebrating the everyday. It is true, however, the second part of what Tolstoy writes is absolutely correct. There is a particular human misery that visits each individual family that are unhappy. Even if it's a straightforward case of a husband who cheats on his wife and the kind of pain she experiences. Well, her pain is different to that of another woman. It's personal to her experience. It's personal to the relationship she had with her husband. And what I like about what Tolstoy says is that it means we're not dismissive of human pain. It means that when the counselor comes in and sees a wife that has been betrayed, he doesn't immediately say, oh, I've seen this before. I know exactly what she's going through. No, you don't. You got to talk to her and listen to her and hear what she's experiencing because you're there to heal. When you go in there, you got to listen to the people, and you have to know exactly what it is that's plaguing them. And it is personal to them. And only then can you bring about a healthy remedy.
One of the things I noticed is that your programs don't just deal with what I call the big five, you know, hitting, gambling, adultery. You deal with the kinds of everyday hurt that many, many families experience. You know, parents who yell too much, spouses who feel distant from each other, people who just feel that they just don't have control over their situation. I want to play a short clip from one family you worked with, the Romero family. This particular clip has you taking them out to a basketball game to create a sense of family unity. Let's hear what happens.
Sometimes before you can work together, you first have to play together. And today I've created an opportunity for the family to rediscover how much they enjoy each other's company.
We're going to have two teams today. Mom's team and Dad's team. Okay, game's up to five. Dad's team starts. Play ball. Let's go.
1-0.
Take ball.
Predictably, the Romeros have chosen sides that reflect the deep division in the family.
How did you figure that out, Rabbi, that that was the dynamic of that family?
It was obvious as soon as we arrived. That was a case of a father who had had an affair. He was caught by a 16-year-old daughter. The two 16-year-old twins were furious at him for having hurt their mom, and they really chose their mom, and they showed their father the cold shoulder. Conversely, the little kids missed their dad. You know, once he was kicked out of the home by the mother, they sort of sided with him. They empathized with him. They pitied him. This was a matter of reminding the family that beyond the pain and heartbreak they had experienced, they had once had joyous times, and they had once felt this sense of cohesiveness. And sometimes it takes a joyous moment, like a simple game, to reintroduce that memory. Family life is a straightforward proposition. Something as simple as a basketball game could really make you feel so much closer.
Could people come up with these ideas on their own? Because one
course.
Of the things that strikes me is we are a country which in some way seems to be awash in therapy. And yet despite all that, these families that you're encountering, many of these people were very isolated and at sea with their problems. But you still come as an outsider and intervene and help them get on the right track.
It's not that we parents can't come up with healthy activities by which to unite the family. It's rather that there are so many corrosive activities that are actually fragmenting families. Let me give you an example. On a Sunday afternoon, what do most families in America do? They go to a shopping mall. That's shocking. You're teaching your kids to live for impulse purchases. You're teaching them that novelty comes about through acquisition. These are all very corrosive things. Does it really take a rocket scientist to conjure up a different Sunday activity, a bike ride, a hike, a museum? Something that teaches the children to appreciate the awe and wonder and inspiration of nature or of great culture. Or here's another example of corrosive activities that fragment families. Watching television. You know how many families are under the impression that doing something together means watching TV together? That's not doing anything together. You're utterly passive. There's no communication. There's no interaction. Your eyes happen to be on the same box. That's it. I mean, you can hardly call that a shared experience. So it's not a matter of thinking up healthy activities. It's a matter of removing the corrosive activities that infringe upon the healthy activities.
Rabbi, hello. You're on television. Just thought I'd mention it.
No, that's a good point. It's a good point. So is there something hypocritical about what I'm saying? Well, no.
Okay.
I'm just being inconsistent rather than hypocritical. Look, let's not be extremists. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that we should cut TV out completely. I mean, Discovery Channel, the sister channel of TLC, now has this thing called Planet Earth on every Sunday night, which just blows you away. Most parents aren't going to be able to take their kids on some trip down the Amazon. So TV can give you things that you might not otherwise find. It's the obsession with it that's just sickening. I mean, if people were to watch an hour, maximum 2 hours of TV a night, no problem. Okay, you know, it's nice. It helps you relieve tension. It introduces you to something new. It makes you laugh. No problem. But 4 hours, 5 hours, and every night, I mean, that's sick.
Looking at your program, it seems to me that a lot of family dynamics seem to revolve around power and control, one parent or another trying to seize control, or the parents trying to regain control from the children. How do people get into that cycle, and how can they get out of it?
You ask an interesting question. I don't know if I've thought in those terms, that it's specifically about power. For me, it's more about feeling loved or not feeling loved. I think that so often, husbands and wives especially, argue over petty trifles, which to them aren't petty because it's a test of whether they're loved. For example, a husband comes home after 10 hours at the office, and he's hungry, and dinner's not ready for him. Well, he makes a big stink of it, and you say to yourself, wow, what an ogre. Why is he making such a big deal of it? Well, to him, it's not about the food. It's that, oh, my wife doesn't care about me. When really, he should just say to his wife, if you need more help around the house, maybe we should spend a bit more, but, you know, I come home and I'm hungry. But he doesn't want to be reasonable because to him, he's injured. His pride is injured. No one cares about me. I don't see that really as about power. I see that as, I think we're a very insecure generation. I think we always question whether we're valuable. I think we question whether we're lovable. The greatest human desire is to love and be loved. And we are not a very loving generation. We conflate, we confuse attention for love. It's the reason why people will eat dung on reality television shows to get in front of a camera thinking that fame is going to make them loved, and it's not true.
How do you find families to let you inside these very personal situations?
You know, there's websites run by TLC where families apply. We get thousands of applications from which we choose 10 per season.
So they want to change. Someone in that family wants something different.
They're desperate for change. You know, when people say to me, oh, these families just want to be on TV, overwhelmingly these are families who turn to me or the network because they don't know where else to get it. Well, let's say you have an out-of-control 14-year-old girl who's having sex. You've tried to talk to them. It doesn't help. What do you do? Do you open a Yellow Pages? So the thing about television is that there's this counselor who they watch and who they begin to trust, and they think, gosh, I wonder if he or she could really help me. And it comes down to knowing the therapist by watching them. Because if you open a Yellow Pages, you're rolling the dice. You don't know whether this person can help you. You don't know what kind of character they have.
Do you think that divorce is ever the answer?
Look, my parents divorced, so obviously I hate divorce. That doesn't mean that it isn't sometimes necessary. I think in life there are three categories. There's the good, the bad, and the necessary. Divorce is never good. It is very often bad, but it is sometimes necessary. There are times when divorce is necessary, when every avenue has been exhausted and the marriage cannot be saved. I mean, there's the obvious things. If a husband beats his wife, they have to get divorced. He can't beat his wife. Chronic infidelity, stuff like that, alcoholism.
Abusing children.
Abusing children, of course. But then there are even emotional issues. Let's say you really are in a loveless marriage, and let's say you've tried everything. Or here's another example. I know husbands who won't go to counseling. Their wives say, you know, we have to go to counseling. He just refuses. Should a wife have to be in a loveless marriage where her husband never talks to her, never touches her, never makes love to her, and live like that for 20 years? That's a prison sentence.
How has this work affected your own family? It's a hard job. I mean, you're on the road quite a bit.
I minimize the time that I spend on the road. We typically every season, we have five families from within the New York area. So that's half the season already that, thank God, I don't have to travel. And five of them, yeah, we do around the United States. And the network has been very accommodating in not making me travel for every single episode. I mean, come on. Like I said, there's no shortage of family dysfunction around where I live.
Mm-hmm.
But we also want to get a cross-section of the country. I don't have to be pushed to spend time with my wife and children, thank God, because it's really where I want to be. It's what I most enjoy. I love being a father. I love seeing my kids grow. I love imparting my interest to my kids. But when I do have to travel for Shalom of the Home, what I've started to do is write like a daily summary of what happened that day with the family, because my kids really enjoy listening to that. So it allows me to bond with them even when I have to travel.
Rabbi, if someone were to be listening to our conversation and felt that his or her family life was less than ideal, and for whatever reason isn't going to write to you, but wants to do something to make a difference, if there was one thing you could ask that person or family to do today to change their dynamics, what would it be?
Talk. Really share your inner self through verbal communication with your spouse and with your kids. If your kids don't listen to you, if they don't like you, share with them the benefit of your experience, of your own pain, of your own growing up, of your own wounds, of your own shortcomings. Let them know who you are. If it's a spouse that you're not close to, let them know what you think the problems are. You know, communication is an amazing thing. It's just that I think in an age of so much noise, radio, TV, iPods, we don't really communicate anymore. We're very passive. There is no substitute for great communication, and that means just being totally honest.
Forgive me if this is too personal, and if it is, please don't answer, but is there ever a time in your own life when you found yourself being a jerk and you had to call yourself up short?
All the time. I wish I could say it was only, you know, to use your words, you know, was there ever a time?
Like
I'm amazed.
Yesterday.
I tell you, I'm 40 years old now, thank God. And I really, you know, the Jewish religion says that when you hit 40, you become wise. And I was waiting for that wisdom to hit me like a freight train. And I now know that you don't just get wisdom in life. You have to acquire it. You got to make the effort to acquire it. I'm amazed at how many mistakes I continue to make. And all you can do in life is forgive yourself for being human and try your best.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteya is the host of TLC's Shalom in the Home. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Michelle.
This week, I was thinking about what else was going on in the world while we were talking about Don Imus. A suicide bomber infiltrated the Iraqi parliament, killing 8 people. The army added 3 months to the standard year-long tour for all active duty soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Vietnam sentenced a pro-democracy activist to 8 years in jail. Yes, a lot is going on in the world. We know this because we're in the news business, and it's our job to keep up. We also know this because among the responses we've been getting from our listeners on Imus is the idea that what he said is just not that big of a deal and people should just get over it. Now, I want to say that wasn't the only or even the dominant point of view among the people who wrote to us. Opinions were all over the place. Some people said, of course he should be fired for what he said. Other people said, he was just joking. He apologized and people should accept that and let him learn from the experience. And there was a third rationale along the lines of, there are just more important things in the world to talk about than one jerk's poor attempt at humor. Can I just tell you, we know there's a lot going on in the world. One of the joys of being in the news business is that it gets you out of your own head. It really forces you to expand your peripheral vision. I think it's a privilege to actually get paid to think about what's going on in the world. But I can't help thinking that the people who keep telling the young women of Rutgers, and by extension, all those who feel that they've been demeaned by these kinds of remarks to get over it, are almost as big a part of the problem as Don Imus is, or was. Because what these people are saying to these young women is pretty much what Don Imus was saying. You don't matter. I find it particularly interesting that the same people who are criticizing civil rights leaders for failing to do enough to stop crude language in hip-hop have themselves shown zero interest in this issue until now. In fact, civil rights activists like the late C. Dolores Tucker and, yes, the Reverend Al Sharpton have been campaigning for years to stop abusive and offensive language in entertainment. Tucker, who died in 2005, filed lawsuits, bought stock in music companies so she could speak at shareholder meetings, and picketed record stores in an effort to eliminate offensive and misogynistic lyrics. She endured vicious ridicule in language I could not possibly repeat here in records by artists like Eminem and Tupac Shakur in retaliation for her efforts. I remember few, if any, of these Imus apologists who blame rap for putting ideas in his 67-year-old head ever supporting or acknowledging Tucker's efforts. Maybe if someone had listened to what she had to say then, had decided it was important amid everything else going on in the world, maybe we wouldn't be where we are now.